What used to be a major risk is now fairly routine. People get organ transplants all the time and live long and happy lives with their replacement organs. In the United States, 35,000 people get transplants every year, which sounds like an impressive number until you see the one next to it. That's the number of people waiting for transplants. By several counts, that's around 115,000 every year. And it explains the birth and growth of a nonprofit called Organize, which seeks to streamline the connections between organs and recipients with the hope of shortening the wait list and lengthening the list of people who get organs. Greg Siegel is the co-founder of Organize with Jenna Arnold, and he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Hi, Greg.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Very good to have you. Your interest in organ donation starts really close to home with your own family. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my father, when I was in college, my father went out for a jog one day and collapsed. And, you know, he was a fully healthy person before that, or at least we thought. And we were told, your dad needs a heart transplant. And for us, this was, you know, not only totally out of the blue, but our next logical question is, okay, so how do we get a heart transplant? And the answer was, you know, put yourself on a waiting list and wait. And for us, it ended up being a 5-year wait. And, you know, just from the understanding the patient experience, my dad waited for 5 years, had 3 open heart surgeries, and came as close to dying as he could have and still survived. And when we got through all of that and I realized this is the best way it could have possibly ended, and for many people it's worse, it felt like this is a system in dire need of reform. So we co-founded Organize, trying to help patients get better access to transplant.
How's your father doing now?
My dad is doing incredibly well. He loves to remind me that his heart is younger than mine is.
Ah. Rubs it in a little, does he?
That's the house I was raised in. There's always a little bit of trash talk.
Okay. So what is the situation for the majority of people awaiting organ transplant? Is his story fairly typical at a 5-year wait for a heart?
Yeah, it is fairly typical. And the number that you gave earlier, how many people are waiting for a transplant, that is absolutely correct based on who's listed. The waiting list, I'll call it a shadow waiting list, is actually far longer than that. Many people who need transplants because of the supply-demand gap never even get waitlisted in the first place. So for my father, not only to receive a transplant, clearly that was the best outcome we could have had. But in many ways, he was fortunate even to be able to have a chance to get waitlisted.
So why do some people get on the list and some people don't?
So hospitals are going to have to make, or I should say transplant centers are going to have to make difficult determinations where they know we're living in a world of highly constrained supply of transplant. We're recovering only about 30% of the potential donors that we could at a national level. So there are going to be a lot of different factors that hospitals have to balance, including, you know, some questions of equity and fairness, who's been waiting the longest, but also the longer you wait for a transplant, the sicker you're going to get, which means probably the worse your outcomes will be in the expected life years post-transplant. So there's the other argument of, if we have a constrained supply of organs available for transplant, how do we optimize life years? So there's a lot of difficult questions, and there's certainly some standardization of the process, but hospitals every day have to make difficult determinations about who is going to get their limited spots on the waiting list.
Something you said, though, just now about 30% of potential donors, that's all the people who are getting identified as actual donors?
Of all of, not all deaths are medically qualified for organ donation. You have to die in specific ways, which ends up being 2-2.5% of deaths in America. About 30% of the ones that are medically qualified for organ donation, between 30-35%, is actually what we end up transplanting. And this is to also just give one other stat to complement that. 95% of Americans per Gallup poll say they believe in or support organ donation. So there's this huge drop-off. It's not just a lack of public support for organ donation. There actually is broad public support for organ donation. There's just a lot of system inefficiencies which cause a lot of opportunity to fall through the cracks about who actually becomes a donor.
And is that a lot of what you're doing at Organize, is trying to make sure that the cracks get smaller and that people don't fall through them as easily?
Exactly right. You know, within about probably a year of founding Organize, we were awarded something called an innovator in residence position in the Office of Health and Human Services in D.C. in the federal government, which essentially the way it worked is we were still a private nonprofit organization, but we had literally and figuratively a desk in the secretary's office of HHS, and we're able to get, you know, great access into, you know, governmental records of, you know, data from hospitals, and we're called organ procurement organizations and transplant centers, and really got end-to-end visibility and tried to understand where in this long chain of stakeholders, are we most suboptimal or missing the biggest potential for transplants? And that's what we've been doing, and published a report recently based on a lot of that access that we had, really highlighting the ways that we could shore up the system and help enable more transplants.
We're talking about organ transplants with Greg Siegel, who's the co-founder with Jenna Arnold of Organize, a nonprofit behind the First Central Organ Donor Registry, and doing some other things to try to clean up and streamline the organization, the organ donation system. You can join the conversation on the exchange, and maybe you have a story to tell about either donating organs or receiving organs. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Does Jenna Arnold have a similar story that led her to want to go down this road, Greg?
I met Jenna socially, and she's just a sucker for a good cause. She'd worked at the UN before this, and I think what really appealed to her about this issue is it's certainly not without its politics or its problems, but it is concretely solvable. And she, I think, had spent most of her career working on these, you know, grand Sisyphean tasks of water and sanitation or, you know, education or human rights, and certainly not making a value judgment about which cause might be more important than another cause. But I think what appealed to her about organ donation is at some level it was sort of math and systems, and we are able mathematically to eliminate the waiting list for lungs and livers and to make big dents in the other organs within a few years if we made some logical policy reforms.
Lungs and livers, can you eliminate the waiting list for those because people can donate parts of those while they're alive?
So you can, that's true for liver. You can't do living lung transplants, but, when you correctly said before, the waiting list for, transplants in this country is 115,000. To be even more, excuse the pun, but surgical about it, it's not that it's equal across all organs. So 90% of the waiting list is actually for kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
So putting that aside for a minute, what it means is the waiting list for other transplants is actually, only a few thousand, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 for different organs. And depending on how people live and how people die, there are sort of differential opportunities for how many hearts or lungs or livers we might be able to recover. But when you look at, certainly I want to help across all organs, but the two that I gave, lungs and livers, the math lines up that if we had an optimal system, supply would exceed demand, and we'd wipe out the waiting list within a couple of years for lungs and livers.
All right, I'll talk about the components of an optimal system in just a moment, but I do have to wonder if on the medical end of things there's a reluctance to even identify people as needing transplants because of the realities of the system. If a physician would say, well, you know, you'd be a candidate except for the fact there's all these other people ahead of you.
Certainly. The problem is that demand exceeds supply, so we have to make these difficult cuts. If we could flip that, certainly, there are far more people that would benefit from transplant than currently are getting the opportunity.
All right, so let's talk about the components of an optimal system. I mean, how do you clear up the avenues of communication and make sure that all the connections are being made that should be made between donors and recipients, and the people have to handle them in the middle, obviously.
Sure. So the last point, the point you ended with is the point they'll lead with is the people in the middle that are running the system. So most people think when you go to the DMV or through another mechanism, you register as an organ donor, that's the end of the story. It's certainly a good thing for people to do that, or at least of the people who want to do that, they should legally record their wishes and certainly should tell their family as well. But that's not the end of the story of organ donation. That's really just the beginning. So the way that it works is, I said before, not all deaths medically qualify for organ donation. But of the ones that do, you're most likely going to pass away in a hospital. The hospital, by process, is supposed to alert the death to what's called an organ procurement organization, an OPO for short. OPOs are federally designated nonprofits. There are 58 of them, each with a geographic monopoly territory. What they're supposed to do is when they receive the call from the hospital saying this is a potential death, they're supposed to show up and work with the family and explain the process of organ donation, help the family come to a decision. And if the family says yes, they then essentially manage the logistics of transporting the organ to a partner transplant center. There is, in the research that we've done, enormous inefficiency and opacity and very little accountability in the way the OPO system works. Some of it for just general inefficiency. Historically, there's been fraud, waste, and abuse. A lot of money has had to be returned for improper expenditures of taxpayer dollars. But there's just very little accountability there. And one of the fundamental problems, including inefficiency, is there's some perverse policy incentives, and there's just an opportunity for OPOs are allowed to essentially self-interpret and self-report their performance information. So there's no essential clear and transparent accounting of how well these organizations are doing. And by extension, no OPO in the 40 years of the system has ever lost its government contract. And that's just there's a lot of opportunities that we think there to increase performance and certainly to increase transparency and accountability to help catalyze improved performance.
Greg Siegel's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about organ transplants and his organization, Organize. He co-founded it with Jenna Arnold, seeks to make sure that people can get to organs more reasonably and that people who want to make donations can make sure their donations are recognized and recorded to take advantage of the opportunities there. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about organ donation and who is affected by it and the long wait lists. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I can imagine you probably got a little resistance from the organ procurement organizations or OPOs when you said, you know, you could do things a lot better.
Every gray hair on this head. But, you know, I fundamentally believe that if people understand what's happening in the system, you can make data-driven arguments. Just about everyone should be in favor of improving the organ donation system. Not only can you improve according to our the reporting, the objective research that we've done while we were working with HHS, up to 25,000 additional lives per year you can save. But closely related, the more people that you can get off of dialysis, dialysis is currently more than a $40 billion federal expense annually. As a John Oliver segment pointed out last year on HBO, it's a full 1% of the federal budget. Anytime you can get somebody a transplant, getting them off of dialysis is a cost saving to taxpayers of about $250,000. So we fundamentally believe that sunlight is a great disinfectant, and if we can make more clear and known true reporting on the state of the industry, it's going to be hard for anyone to object to some of the conclusions that we've reached.
Talk about some of the issues that you mentioned, that 90% of the list is kidneys, and people can give one of these and still have one left for themselves and still live a great life. It would seem like that would be a fairly easy organ to be able to donate. Is that not the case?
So all things relative. It's certainly easier than many other surgeries that you can have. It still is a surgery, and longitudinal data on the health of recipients isn't entirely proven out and clear yet. Organ donation is still a fairly nascent science. That being said, absolutely, we are big proponents of living donation, or at least of all potential donors and recipients getting all the information necessary to make an informed decision for them about living donation. That being said, not everybody has someone in their life who is willing and medically able to give them a kidney, and a lot of people also feel a discomfort receiving a kidney from someone in their social circle because it creates either weird feelings of obligation, or it's certainly not a riskless surgery. So many people say, I can never ask one of my kids to do that. And then if you extend beyond someone's close social circle, it obviously gets harder and harder to find someone who might be willing to donate to you.
Okay, so a bunch of issues there. Let's come back to the OPOs, the organ procurement organizations, and have there been changes made based on the recommendations you made through Organize?
So we are in the process of certainly working with elected officials. Senator Todd Young from Indiana, just a couple weeks ago before the holidays, announced that he will be introducing legislation in the next Congress that we are very big supporters of. And that's something that absolutely, I hope, can be a galvanizing moment for anyone who cares about this issue or maybe has never understood this issue before, that we can start to try to drive some of the issues that we need. But at Organize, we've spent the last couple of years really trying to gather access to a lot of the data that we need and do really informed reporting. We've been working with the Laura and John Arnold Foundation, which is a Giving Pledge Foundation based in Houston, University of Pennsylvania, and the Bridgespan Group, which is essentially a social good consulting group based out of Boston, and just a couple weeks ago published our final report. And I've been very heartened, no pun intended, to see that within a couple days of doing so, we were able to drive a commitment from a sitting senator to drive reform on this issue in the next cycle.
Have you been able to push the numbers yet? Have you been able to say, hey, look, you know, the lists are different now since Organize got involved?
The lists certainly are different now in that the need grows every single year. But historically, the way people have tried to address this issue has been through, you know, just promoting more registration drives for organ donation. That's certainly, I'm a big proponent of increasing donor registration rates. I think that's necessary, but by no means sufficient. So what we're hoping to do and are working towards is more honest and transparent reporting of where the actual drop-off and inefficiencies occur, and trying to push federal policy solutions that'll help intelligently address some of these issues.
Greg Siegel's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about organ donation and organ transplant. He's the co-founder of Organize with Jenna Arnold. It's a nonprofit designed to speed things up and to make better connections and to make sure that the more people who get transplants or need transplants get transplants and that more organs are donated. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. This is not just focused, as I should point out, within the transplant industry. You're not just focused on the organ procurement organizations, because there are some communications realities of our time that you're trying to turn to the advantage of people waiting for transplants. Talk about some of your social media efforts and outreach.
Absolutely. So, you know, before we sort of anchored on policy solutions as the fundamental driver of what change is going to be, we worked very hard and very closely with a lot of social media platforms in essentially trying to modernize the way people are able to communicate their organ donor wishes. So most people think when you register as an organ donor, they think about going to the DMV and putting on your driver's license, and that is absolutely a good way to make your wishes known. But the way the original law is written, which talks about, it's called the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, excuse my being crude, but essentially property rights for corpses, the way people can make any sort of affirmative statement about what they want to happen to their body after they pass. The definition essentially of what qualifies as an organ donor registration is, quote, any statement or symbol that reflects the donor's wishes. So what we got really interested in is understanding, if the law was written so expansively and broadly, why was it implemented so narrowly just at the DMV? And that really just tied back to the realities of, this was in 1968, if you wanted the most scalable place where you could identify somebody credibly their identity, the DMV was, may sound silly now, but sort of the cutting edge distribution platform and technology of 1968, where you could do that scalably. And we did a fundamental rethinking of, if all people need to do is affirmatively state what their wishes are and make them known to next of kin, there are a multitude of platforms now that will allow people to do that more easily and readily than at the DMV. So essentially built technology systems which allow the OPOs or whatever team is working with the donor's family to, if the donor's family wants, do a quick search to see if they'd ever posted anything on social media using the hashtag organ donor, which may contain their wishes or beliefs about organ donation, to help families make informed decisions.
And you actually developed a donor tool for use through Facebook, is that right?
That's exactly right. So you can, just post not just on Facebook, but on social media or Instagram, if you share what your wishes are and you want to say, I want to be a hashtag organ donor, we're able to help pull that information and make it available to families, which accomplishes fundamentally two things. It's certainly an easier process than going to the DMV and registering, or even, you know, if you go on the DMV's website, a lot of people may not have a driver's license or some other form of identification, or may not want to be in what they feel like is a governmental list where you need to include your Social Security number. For a lot of people, this is an easier, more flexible way to do it. But also, we really try to think holistically about the purpose of this isn't just to communicate someone's wishes, but to communicate their wishes to their family that'll have to make this decision in a time of both, shock and tragedy. Surviving next of kin is about 33% less likely to suffer from depression or PTSD if they know what your wishes were after having lost you, assuming that they have to make a decision. So we really tried to think not just what are the easiest ways to allow people to communicate their wishes, but what are the most compassionate and human-centered ways that people will want to receive this information when they have to make the determination. And is it on a sterile DMV form, Or is it, a personalized post that someone might have put on social media saying, you know, Mom, I hope you never have to see this, but if you do, I want to be a hashtag organ donor, and, you know, maybe sharing some inspirational article that they saw about organ donation. For us, we just felt like this is a great use of technology to help connect people, to communicate some of the most fundamentally important things you'll ever need to communicate in your life.
Greg, in addition to the communication part of it, are you also working on an avenue to try to expand the zone of what organs are available or what medical conditions in which organs are available for donation?
Sure. So what's actually really interesting about this is organ donation started in the 60s, but it really became more common or prevalent in the 1980s, and that coincided with the advent of immunosuppressive drugs. So we have essentially seminal legislation in this country, which set up an organ donation system in 1984 called the National Organ Transplant Act. Since then, science has continued to improve, so readily and rapidly. And every year there are new advancements in, you know, can we recover organs from patients with hepatitis C or from HIV positive donors? And are there still, recipients who would benefit from these and might have a life-changing and life-improving experience? The science just improves so readily in a still historically fairly nascent science. And we have a regulatory system which was built in the 1980s, which really has, other than around the fringes, has not been updated to meet with scientific advancement. So this is one of the things that we're really interested in, is trying to create this regulatory environment which not only accomplishes some of the things we discussed earlier in this call, but is more nimble and reactive to the constantly improving state of medical science, so that we can continue to optimize not just the donor pool in terms of, you know, what we talked about earlier, when OPOs only recovered 30% of potential, mm-hmm. how can we get them to recover more, but also thinking about how can we increase the pool of who's eligible in the first place.
All right, medical science, computer science, and social science all coming together at organize.org, where Greg Siegel is the co-founder. Thanks for joining us today.